Hey, glad you can make it. And welcome to the Employee Cycle Podcast, where we talk to HR innovators, thought leaders, and even some disruptors about the latest in HR trends, HR tech, and you guessed it, HR data. Well, you've heard enough of me talking. Now let's start the show.
Hey, hey, everyone. Welcome back to the Employee Cycle Podcast. I'm your host, Bruce Marable, CEO and co-founder of Employee Cycle. And you know us, we're your HR analytics dashboard that keeps you from pulling messy spreadsheets from all your different HR systems. That's right. We know you're exporting crappy, messy spreadsheets from a lot of different HR systems and trying to turn them into some type of spreadsheet dashboard. And that's why we created Employee Cycle, to be able to pull all that data from all those different systems into one real-time, streamlined, beautiful HR dashboard for you. But that's enough about me and Employee Cycle, because today I would like for you to help me welcome a very special guest, and that is Karen Fleshman, founder of Racy Conversations, one of the coolest company names ever. And today we're going to talk about how to address microaggressions in the workplace. Karen, welcome to the podcast.
Woo! Thank you.
Karen!
Chris! I'm super honored to be here. I really value the work that you're doing, and I love speaking to HR professionals about one of my favorite topics.
Awesome. So the question that we always ask to kick this thing off is, how did you end up in the wonderful world of HR?
The early part of my career was in the immigrants' rights movement, and I shifted focus to workforce development when I was working for the city of New York, and reports came out that said 50% of Black men in New York City don't have a job, and we have 200,000 young adult New Yorkers, almost entirely Black and Latinx, who are not in school, not working. And so I was like, we need to connect young people to internships and employers. And I did that work for a good 10 years, worked for a really great organization called Year Up, connecting young adults who don't have a college degree to corporate careers in tech. And then come to find out, talking to the Year Up students, that they are experiencing just nonstop microaggression, macroaggression, abuse, you know, at these companies. And that was when I realized, you know, there's a lot of people like me. I grew up in a virtually all white community. I've made my career in Austin, New York City, now San Francisco, exact same trends in all these places of limitless career opportunities for white college-educated professionals like me who come to these cities, but who have very limited lived experience interacting across difference. And now we're in the workforce, we're oftentimes in positions of authority within the workforce, and we just don't have those skills. And so out of all of this comes a lot of unnecessary and very traumatic workplace interactions. And so that's how I came to found Racy Conversations. Our mission is to inspire the first anti-racist generation. So we're really targeting millennial and Gen Z professionals in the workplace, and helping them to develop the skills, what Audre Lorde taught us, to relate across difference as equals.
Wow, that is a lofty, ambitious, and amazing goal of the first, did you say, anti-racist generation?
Exactly. You know, I'm very much influenced by Dr. Ibram Kendi, How to Be an Anti-Racist, and, you know, that just not being a racist is insufficient. You know, we have to be actively anti-racist. And you know, we're an entire society, economy, politics built on racism. So it takes a lot to go from just kind of, you know, floating along with the status quo to actively going against the status quo. But that's what we at Racy Conversations aim to do.
And I had a couple questions prepared, but I think this podcast might be totally off script, because there's so many interesting things that you're talking about already. So before we even go into the topic, I need you to help me and everyone else listening really understand, what is anti-racism?
Great question. Well, let's start with what is racism. So Audre Lorde said that racism is the belief in the inherent superiority of one race above all others, and thereby the right to dominance. Dr. Kendi talks about being an anti-racist as opposed to being a racist. And he says, to be anti-racist means to be actively involved in going against a racist policy or a racist practice. And kind of to be racist is to just go with the flow, you know, because racism is kind of the bottom line. It's like the underlying operating system. So if you're just not paying attention, or you know, you don't have to be like a KKK member to be a racist. You're just, if you just maintain the status quo, you are effectively being a racist, because that is what the status quo is designed to create, racial inequality.
That's so interesting. It reminds me of the cliche saying, there's never an opportunity for you to not choose. You either choose one way or the other, but you're always choosing or making the decision how you feel about something, which is really interesting. So let's tie this really interestingly into the topic of how to address microaggressions in the workplace. I'm sure we're going to talk about racism and how that directly correlates to this issue. But the same way that we defined anti-racism, let's define what a microaggression is so that we can be on the same page. And then I think you also spoke about in your intro, macroaggression versus microaggression.
Yeah. Well, you know, and I kind of don't like the term microaggression, because for the people experiencing the microaggression, it does not feel micro at all. You know, it feels macro. It feels, Dr. Kendi prefers the term abuse. And so Chester Pierce, who was a psychiatrist and on the faculty of Harvard University, was the originator of the concept of microaggression. He's also the psychiatrist who created Sesame Street and wanted kids to grow up seeing this very racially integrated neighborhood and people, and developing that kind of seeing that on a daily basis. I think that's really interesting. And then the concept was sort of further evolved by Daryl Dwing Su and psychologists at Columbia University. And the short definition of it is casual degradations of people in marginalized groups. And it can be verbal. It can be through looks, like nonverbal or physical. And it can also be environmental, like having certain artwork or depictions hanging in the room.
Got it. So you really set this up to set a framework for how we can define, look at, and help HR leaders identify these microaggressions, but for the sake of what you just said, let's call it abuse, how they can identify these types of abuse in the workplace. And so when it comes to the three different types you just spoke of, let's start with verbal. What type of verbal abuse is typically happening in the workplace where people would today define it as a microaggression? And then let's go into, how can HR leaders or anyone in the company really identify how this is happening and what you can do to not only stop it from happening, but proactively keep your culture from dealing with this toxic behavior?
Sure. Before we go there, I think it's important to understand, why do microaggressions happen? And I think it's, again, the history is extremely important. I'm actually writing a book right now for white women about our role in all of this. And it really is rooted in behavioral patterns that have built up over 400 years of U.S. history, including the genocide and land theft of Native Americans and slavery, and the kinds of relationships that were established during slavery, Reconstruction, Jim Crow, all the way through the post-civil rights era and the advent of law and order and mass incarceration. So I think first we have to understand that we are coming into the workplace because, as I mentioned, many of us grow up in very intentionally created geographical segregation, educational segregation. There's many folks like me, you know, I grew up in an all-white community. My parents taught me racism is terrible. Dr. Martin Luther King is wonderful. And the way to not be racist is to be colorblind and treat everybody the same. But I never actually saw them do that. It wasn't intentional on their part. It's just that because we lived in an all-white community, you know, we didn't have relationships across difference. Meanwhile, at school, I'm seeing, you know, these films that are designed to motivate us not to do drugs. That's basically depictions of Black people overdosing on heroin. And I'm learning all this really inaccurate stuff about U.S. history. And so as I grew older and started to notice, well, why is there so much racial inequality? The story I got back was, you know, we used to have terrible racism, but then there was a civil rights movement led by Dr. King, and now opportunities are distributed equally. And some families like ours work really hard, and that's why we have what we have. And other families choose not to, and that's why they're in the situation that they're in. And had I not spent all that years developing relationships with young adults, through working at Year Up, I think that would still be my understanding of racial inequality. So I think you have to start with educating your workforce about the root drivers of racial inequality and sort of overriding all these myths and as I like to say, harmful and inaccurate explanations that we learned from our parents and at school growing up. What's interesting is social psychologists have actually studied interracial interactions to figure out why they so frequently result in microaggression. And what they have found is that white people and people of color come into these interactions with very different understanding of inequality and also very different goals. So white people come into the interaction with the goal of wanting to be liked, and people of color come into the interaction with the goal of wanting to be respected. The white person, like me, you know, frequently has very limited experience relating across difference, are not self-aware of our racial advantages. We definitely want affirmation that we're not racist. We're very nervous about could we be, you know, could someone perceive us as racist? So all of this goes into our head. And what comes out is we're like, oh, I know people of color are really informal. So I'm going to act really informal and then they will like me. Okay, so then we say some awkward thing about some musician or TV show or just some random thing, right? In an attempt to get the person of color to like us, to show that we're trying to relate with them based on our understanding of who they are. Whereas the person of color comes into the interaction often with a lot of experience having interacted with white people and a very you know, having had some really negative interactions with a clear understanding of the drivers of racial inequality, they come into the interaction wanting to be respected, wanting to be seen as an individual. They have no desire to be liked or to become this person's friend. And they also want to be seen as an individual and not as a representative of their entire racial group. So when the white person talks about some artist or, you know, uses some vernacular in an attempt to reach out, the person of color takes that as an insult takes it as a sign of disrespect. And that's where the microaggression frequently occurs. So part of what I do in my workshops is really educate people how to build relationships based in trust that do not result in microaggression. And it's really pretty simple. It's like, just be respectful, you know, start from a point of higher formality, work your way down, treat everybody as an individual and not as a representative of whatever group you perceive them as being. Of course, don't ignore and don't try to be colorblind, because no one really is colorblind. And if I am looking at you and we're having an interaction and I'm trying to suppress the entire time that you are a Black man, I'm like erasing your reality, right? And then as we start to build trust, then we can start to talk about that a little bit. But I urge people not to dive right in with that, but just say, hey, you know, how are you? Bruce, thank you so much for having me here today and building relationship formally. So let me stop there and see if you have any questions about that. And then I'll go into what are some examples of verbal, environmental, and physical microaggression.
I'm smiling as you're speaking because I have 1,000 questions about what you just said. And I'm consciously thinking, how much time do we have in this interview? Because you literally have made me think about every single interaction that I've had with someone outside of my race in a very different way than I've never thought about it before. And I think I might just need to even talk to you a lot more even after this, based off of my experiences.
Thank you so much. You know what's so funny, Bruce, is that for many, I'm a lawyer, right? I don't have any training in social work or psychology or anything like that, but I literally, a lot of my time I dedicate to just listening to people's experiences and affirming for them, you know, that they are not making this up, that this really happened. Because I think another really unhealthy aspect of microaggression is that sometimes the person who's the recipient is like, wait, what just happened? And then they start to question their own reality, right? They're like, why did that happen? What, you know, and so I think it's very affirming for people to understand you are not making this shit up. You know, this really did happen.
Because what you're saying is so compelling and so powerful, what I would like to do is reframe the question that I ask, and not based off of the framework of talking about verbal, nonverbal, or environmental, but let's now talk about it in the context of how do people perform microaggressions in these areas, and then what they can do to better identify when they may be doing it, versus the person who may be experiencing someone being abusive and performing a microaggression on them, and how they can navigate through that. Because what you're saying is so much bigger than HR, but you're just talking about people and how we relate with our differences. So if we could start with verbal, that would be awesome.
Yeah. So a verbal microaggression is like a verbal slight to someone that oftentimes said by the person doing it, they think they're making a compliment, right? So telling someone, you're so articulate. I have a great example from a workshop I recently did. A guy raised his hand and said, you know, we had a new woman join our team, and the leaders of the team decided to throw a potluck for her. And since she was Latina, they decided to make it a Mexican food themed party. Okay. And then they started circulating a list, and they were all putting down different Mexican foods they were going to bring, like nachos and I don't know, breakfast burritos and all this stuff. And so this young man who was Filipino American pointed out to them that this was really messed up, you know, that before we assume that this woman would want a Mexican-themed potluck. Why don't we ask her? And then the whole thing got very embroiled in controversy, and the leadership of the team wound up canceling the potluck. And then they put all the blame on the young Filipino guy for raising this as an issue. And I was like, oh my God, this is just a classic example. Like, I'm sure the leader, you know, the manager of the team, the people who came up with this concept had the best of intentions. They're like, okay, we have a young Latina woman joining our team. How can we make her feel welcome? Oh, I know. Let's throw a Mexican themed potluck, right? Without understanding that you just don't make assumptions about people. I said, you know, the easiest way this could have been prevented is if they just said to her, hey, we want to have a potluck to celebrate you joining the team. Is there any particular kind of food that you like? Right? It's like so easy to prevent something like this. But when people make assumptions or they try to show that they're super culturally competent, but they're really not, that's when these things really, really start to manifest. So I would say a verbal microaggression is anything that shows, you notice that the person you're interacting with is from some marginalized group and you have limited experience interacting with that marginalized group, but you're trying to make it seem like you're cool with them or, basically that. And then you wind up saying something totally awkward.
And let's just break that down a little further for people who are listening to really get, for a person who could probably and most likely is in a position to be the aggressor and the abuser, to really understand that, because I know a lot of things can get lost in translation. So for instance, when you say that assumptions are the basis for a lot of microaggressions, especially verbal, what is the assumption that was made that was incorrect or unfair? Was it that she was Mexican and then maybe she was not Mexican? Whether she was or not, it's just that the assumption, without anyone checking, is the assumption that even if they know that she is Mexican, that she likes Mexican food and or would want a Mexican theme potluck? What exactly it's, because I feel that when we have these national debates or we have people going back and forth and arguing about this, or it turns into even some type of physical altercation, we never really talk about the deep-rooted issue that happened. It's more so, oh yeah, you just shouldn't assume. And I'm sure you have an answer to this, which is why I ask.
Yeah, I think it's all of the above. I think it's about, if we want to build relationships based in trust, we have to recognize that there are very real differences between us, but treat people as individuals and not make assumptions about them. We have to learn how to relate across difference as equals, again, as Audre Lorde taught us, because we don't have any patterns to follow. We only know how to relate across difference in hierarchy, right? And that this is good and that's bad. And thereby, I have dominance. And when you're a white American, like you know, you're surrounded by whiteness is good. You know, you live in an all white community, go to an all white school. Not entirely, right? It's like maybe 95%, right? You get catalogs coming to your house with all these images of white people living this kind of carefree existence. And then it's in the TV shows, it's in the movies. So you grow up with this kind of image. And then, you know, I sit down with Bruce and I'm like, Bruce, you're so articulate. Right. And so to me, it's like, well, you know, I just kind of have this image that Black people aren't that articulate because I've never really spent any time with articulate Black people. And I've seen lots of Black people on TV or whatever who, you know, spoke in vernacular. And so I'm kind of stunned when I sit down with Bruce, you know, and then, but when I say that to you, Bruce, how does that make you feel?
Now the 36-year-old Bruce I mean, I think I laugh at it because I've heard it so many times and I understand where it's coming from. And when I say understand, it's not giving a pass to the other person, but it's, that's their shit again. Like it's that type of thing, because I know that's something that people will do. It's wrong. When I was younger and I would get it, absolutely. It would make me feel uncomfortable. It would be weird. I wouldn't exactly know how to respond to it. At this point, I think I've become so bold and outspoken that I would hear it and I would say, was there a specific word that I said that makes me articulate? And I think at this point now, it's not even me being an asshole, but now I think I'm so comfortable in just making other people feel uncomfortable based off of what they said, because it doesn't really faze me anymore. So at this point, it's more, okay, we're about to play this chess match and we're gonna see where this goes. So, because I used the word there? Was that? And then to see the person, and I'm like, you know, it's whatever. But yeah, that's kind of what I do now.
Yeah. Well, but imagine if we could just eliminate all this. And imagine if we could actually equip people with the relationships, with the skills to build relationships based in trust. Because yes, there are some very ill-intentioned people in the workplace. You know, there are some real terrible people. But then there's a lot of other people who are not, you know, but they literally don't know how to do this. And I think there's also a big generational shift going on. So, you know, you think about one of the slides I always present in my workshops is this living portrait of the United States by generation. And it breaks it down from the silent generation born 1928 to 1945 to Generation Z, the racial demographics of each generation. And so in the millennials, 43% of U.S. millennials identify as people of color. In Generation Z, 47% identify as people of color. And also whole shifts in sexual identities, in gender identities, in sexual orientations among Generation Z and millennials. So they're coming into the workplace with the expectation that people in the workplace have done their homework, understand all these different races and ethnicities, gender identities, sexual orientations. And then the people in the workplace, many from my generation, so I'm Gen X, and then, of course, the boomers and older people, we grew up in a very different demographic. And so folks come into the workplace with all these expectations and we're like, what? I've never even heard of that. You know, so there is like a big gap there. But that's where I think racy conversations are really needed, because we need to sit down and in a no shame, no blame environment, understand how these things originated so people can change their behavior. Now, once we've given them that instruction and the help and the guidance they need to change their behavior, then they actually need to change their behavior. You know, then there's just no excuse. And honestly, there's no excuse as it is now. Like anyone could spend some time to figure this out, but we'll give them the benefit of the doubt. But I do think it is really important to have these kinds of conversations in the workplace and to help people develop these skills. So do you want to talk about now, like, how to actually intervene if you see a microaggression?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. So I would say the first thing is when a person is being microaggressed, they are highly unlikely to speak out on their own behalf. So I think it's really important that the people around them are paying attention and that they speak out on their behalf, and that we become what's called an upstander. Now, I think it's also very important not to become a white savior type person, like swooping in, oh, I'm going to save the day. So first, I ask that people check in with the person that they perceived as having experienced harm and just say, hey, I noticed your interaction with so-and-so and it felt a little off. And I just wanted to see, are you okay? And then listen, right? And then say, if it's okay with you, I would like to say something to so-and-so person. And make sure that it is okay with them, because you don't really know what the dynamic may be there. Maybe they don't want anything said, but it can also just be very validating to know that someone else saw it and saw that it was bad. Okay, then I would go say something to the person, and I would pull them aside and say it to them privately, because you want them to be able to listen and you don't want them to feel super ashamed, and say, hey, you know, I noticed your interaction with so-and-so and it felt off to me. And I just wanted to ask you, you know, what were you thinking in that interaction? And get an understanding from them what their intent was. And then say, you know, I know you didn't intend it in this way, but this is the impact that it had on this person. This is how it felt to that person. And so I'm bringing this to your attention because I actually care about you. And I want to give you the opportunity to address this with that person and to change your behavior. So it's not like, you know, I'm not like yelling at the person. I'm not presenting myself as superior. I'm just pointing it out to them the same way I would point out to them that they had some spinach between their teeth, that, you know, you might want to correct this. I think that's really important. Sometimes there's not time enough for a full-blown interaction like that. Sometimes you need to address it in real time. So like, say you're in a meeting and one of your colleagues keeps trying to say something and everybody's talking over her. You could say, hey, I couldn't help but notice that Evie's been trying to say something. Could we give her the opportunity to speak?
That sounds reasonable.
Right?
Yeah. So now let's go to nonverbal.
Mm-hmm.
What does that look like as the aggressor? And then how should you navigate that when that happened?
So, for example, a friend of mine sued for employment discrimination, wrongful termination. And when she went in the hearing room, there was a picture of George Washington with like enslaved people hanging in the hearing room, you know, with him chopping down the cherry tree, which is totally inaccurate. I mean, George Washington, that whole story about him chopping down the cherry tree is a fiction created by his biographer. But, you know, here she is, a Black woman there to talk about her experience of employment discrimination. And she has to look at this picture of, you know, the intent behind that picture being always tell the truth. And so when she raised it to the judge and said, you know, this is actually inappropriate, then she became the problem, right? So I think environmental microaggressions can be artwork like that. It can be, you know, from a sexual harassment perspective, like if you're there at work and you know that your colleagues are looking at porn on their phones or on their laptop, just different things like that. So it's in your space. You're seeing these harmful depictions is an environmental microaggression.
Did we skip to environmental, or were we talking about nonverbal and environmental together?
Oh, okay. Yes. So I thought you asked me about environmental. A nonverbal could be like a physical microaggression. Like it could be giving people a look like, you know, do you really belong here? Kind of following them in a store or even in the workplace, like assuming that someone is doesn't belong in the workplace and kind of staring at them, like, what are you doing here? Could be a nonverbal microaggression.
And then if that's happening to you and you're the person where this abuse is happening to, how should you navigate through this? So not only that you get through it, but I'm imagining that the ideal situation would be so that the other person learned from it and that you're actually correcting the behavior.
Yes. I mean, if you feel strong enough and bold enough, I highly encourage you to speak directly to the person who's doing the harmful behavior and correct their assumption about you. if that is a lot for you to do, I highly recommend banding together with other folks from your group and raising this as an issue with people of authority within the workplace and asking them to address it. I do think there is huge power in numbers, and that especially with so many of the millennial and Gen Z workforce being people of color, like raising these issues to your workplace leaders and saying, hey, this is happening to us all the time, and we need you to take action to prevent this from occurring because it's really harmful and toxic, I think is something that could be transformative. The other thing is to sue. You know, I have a lot of friends who are coming forward with employment discrimination lawsuits, and we just saw the JP Morgan, where the client and the team member were actually recording different interactions, and they're going to be suing. I think this is going to be big in the 2020s because it's just unacceptable. People should not have to be dealing with this kind of abuse 50 years after Dr. King and countless others gave their lives to a movement to get our laws changed. You know, we shouldn't have to sue to vindicate those rights. Like, workplaces should take this seriously and prevent it from happening.
Wow. This is all very serious work and a lot of things that need to happen to not only make the workplace better, but just to make the world better in general. So definitely applaud you and everyone else who is working in this space on trying to make this better. But now we're going to move into a slightly lighter topic, and which, you know, it's always interesting moving from a very serious topic to my silly section of the podcast, which I like to call the real, the random, and ridiculous, but we're going to have fun with it anyway. So are you ready?
I am totally ready. I love being silly.
All right. So the real question, do you like to eat bread pudding? And if so, how do you like it made? Just so you know, that is the real question. That is a very real question to me.
Wow. Do I like to eat bread pudding?
Yep. And if so, how do you like it made?
No, I'm not a big bread pudding person.
Karen, you were doing so well on this podcast. And now you just took the direction totally into the to a bad place. But I forgive you.
Thank you.
I forgive you.
It's okay. You know rice what? Pudding. Is we're that okay?
Even, we're not even going to dig into it anymore. That's okay. That's a question that I can definitely just skip by. So the random question. Mm-hmm. What's one of the most random ways people perceive you based off of the work that you're doing? Based off of who you are and your background and ethnicity, what's a random perception of who you are based off of this type of work?
Wow. Well, one thing that happens a lot when I'm in the East Coast is people will come up to me and speak Spanish to me and assume that I'm Latina, which I always take as a big compliment. That makes me feel really good. Okay. But I, you know, a kind of random, it's like some people will be like, what is this white woman doing talking about this stuff? She's just trying to capitalize off of people of color's pain, which really hurts because I'm not trying to capitalize off of people of color. I'm trying to relieve people of color's pain. And it's not like I'm out here making a fortune doing this. I mean, it's, if I gave lighter weight workshops, I would have a much bigger demand for my services. But because my workshops tend to be pretty intense, you know, it takes a special employer to be like, okay, we're going to hire her to come in here.
Got it. That's really interesting. And I might even have to have you on as a guest again to talk about what it means to be an advocate to overlooked or unbiased or populations that receive a lot of bias, because I think that's something worth exploring and also hearing both sides of that. But in regards to the ridiculous question, What do you think, let me make sure I'm wording this correctly, I'm sure that you've heard a lot of people say that microaggressions in and of itself is a ridiculous thing, and it's not real, and people are just too sensitive, or whatever they believe is the case for the person who's actually being abused. So what is the most ridiculous thing that you've heard, either by an employer or someone that you were speaking with at a company, could have been an executive, where they say, oh, you know what, Garen, I like you, this was a great coffee, this was a great meeting, but I just don't even see this being a real thing.
What is the most ridiculous thing an employer has said to me?
About that. Or have you found that, and I would be super shocked and surprised, but have you found that every company you talk to was like, yeah, microaggressions. Yeah, we have those. We need to fix those.
Yeah, I mean, how can I put it? Most of the people who hire me are women of color. And so they're saying, we do have these microaggressions here, and we need someone who's going to come in and really help us to understand that. So I don't get that kind of pushback from employers. I would say I get it more, you know, from trolls and social media and stuff like that. And this whole kind of right wing, you know, where they call us snowflakes and stuff like that. Yeah, that's where I hear it more than from employers, because the people who are advocating to have me come in have already raised that it's a real issue. And the employer is open enough to listening to them that they're willing to bring me in. So I don't get a lot of pushback from employers.
Got it. Well, this is a great place to end the podcast, although I could talk to you for days about this because this topic is so interesting and it's so nuanced and there's so much tension around it, especially with all the things you just talked about from a political standpoint. But either way, Karen, you've been an awesome, awesome, awesome podcast guest. Thank you for being on the Employee Cycle Podcast, Karen!
Thank you, Bruce! Thank you! And I hope you won't be puddingist and prevent me from returning based on my unacceptable answer.
No, it's all fun. It's all fun. So, where can people find you and Racy Conversations online?
Okay, we're at racyconversations.com. My biggest social media is LinkedIn. I'm under my name, Karen Fleshman. I'm also on Instagram and Facebook and Twitter at Fleshman Karen.
Awesome. And we'll be sure to put all that information in the show notes. So all of you listening out there, thank you so much for listening to this podcast interview, because we would be nothing without you. And because we care so much about your opinion, we would love if you left us a 5-star rating on iTunes or whatever else you want to leave us a rating, because that shows that you care and that we're providing great content and we want to hear your feedback. Also, if this was the first Employee Cycle episode you've ever listened to, and that's because you're already a super fan of Karen, or you find this topic to be so compelling you just had to listen, but now you're hungry for more awesome podcast episodes, then please subscribe to the Employee Cycle Podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever other amazing podcast player you're using. And last but not least, all you HR and people ops leaders out there, please continue to hire, train, and retain the best workforce possible. Thanks. Later, kids.
This episode of the Employee Cycle Podcast was edited and produced by Lux Podcast Production. Lux is a creative audio suite that helps clients create, market, and measure their show. Visit luxpodcasts.com to learn how a podcast can benefit your organization. That's LUXE podcasts.com.